You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius. I just wanted to play music. I just wanted to be a DJ. And when you DJ on the radio, more people hear you. It's simple as that.
Straight from the streets of Brooklyn, it's Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we talk to Cypher Sounds. Cypher is best known for being a DJ and on-air personality at New York's Hot 97. But, as you'll hear, he's had a career that's taken him from the center of backpack underground rap to the heights of commercial blinged-out success. He was also the DJ on The Chappelle Show, and his association with Chappelle led him to start a second career as a stand-up and improv comic. We talked to Cypher at our Rap Genius office in Brooklyn. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special kind of audio footnote. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL44. There, you'll find audio, video, and more information to bring you further outside the lines. Now, here's our talk with Cypher Sounds. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.
Thanks.
Host Same Old Sean here with Cypher Sounds.
That's me. Yeah. Same old Cyph.
So for our folks who don't know, I'm sure everyone in New York knows, but for people outside.
I'm global.
Can you give us a little rundown of who you are?
I'm a Hot 97 morning show host with me, Peter Rosenberg, Kate Fox, and Ebro. I've been at Hot 97 for like 15 years now. I started off as an intern for Funkmaster Flex, climbed the ladder to eventually get my own show, the morning show. I've done too much. I A&R'd for Raucous, for Tommy Boy, for Pharrell Star Track Label. I used to DJ for Lil' Kim, for Big Pun. I used to A&R for Jay-Z's label, Rockefeller, before it folded, and Def Jam. I was a DJ on Chappelle's show. I had a show on MTV. I do a lot.
You can see that. We'll get to a lot of that. Yeah. And also now a comedian.
Yeah. My focus mostly lately is on comedy. Because it seems to be the thing that worked the most for me, like popped me off the furthest. So
yeah. I wanted to kind of take it back to the radio stuff a little bit.
Yeah.
You were obviously a DJ for years and years. That was the beginning of your career. But there's a difference between being a DJ and being like a radio personality.
Yeah.
And it seems like that switch maybe happened, I don't know, past maybe 7 or 8 years for you, something like
yeah.
that?
Yeah. I just wanted to play music. I just wanted to be a DJ. And when you DJ on the radio, more people hear you. It's simple as that. Like, I just wanted to play music, DJ records. And when I got with Flex, he asked me to be his intern assistant at the radio station. So radio kind of I just kind of fell into it. I never wanted to be an on-air personality or be a legend like Frankie Crocker or Howard Stern. I just wanted to play music, and that was a good way to get more people to hear you. So after a while, my boss would say, oh, you say funny stuff on the radio. I'm going to try you as an on-air personality, as a jock. And I was like, nah, I don't want to do that. I definitely don't want to do that. Please don't make me do that. And she was like, no, I think it's going to work for you. Either you're going to do it or you're fired. So I was like, all right, let's give it a try.
Nice. What was that like when you first started doing it?
It was weird. It was weird because it's like,
But it's easy being funny when no one's listening, right? Or no one's expecting it.
Yeah, because what I was funny with was when I was DJing, I would turn on the mic and say funny things about the song. Or like if the song is about going out with your girlfriends, I'd make a little joke about, make sure you, you know, keep your shoes on at the end of the night, you know, like jokes like that.
Yeah.
But it was all tied into the music. So when I became a personality, like, you're like just talking in a room to no one. And at least when I'm playing music, like on a Friday night, if I play like a good song, you can see the phone lines react. And you get like some kind of like, it's not me talking, it's me like playing someone else's song. So it feels good. Me talking always felt horrible. Like I was like, what do I talk about? What do I do?
Wow. And you've had recently on the show, you've had another kind of addition to the crew, right? Your boss kind of jumped on as an on-air personality.
So weird. I mean, he always was one. And Ebro, he did radio on the West Coast. And then when he came here, he was on the morning for a while. But him jumping on now is weird because it's like, this is an element that we needed and he fit the criteria. So he was like, all right, I'll jump in and do this and that. And it's like, we usually talk shit about him in the morning and now he's there. So it's like, we have to like hold it in.
Right, right. And the as far as the like talking on air stuff, was there a point at which you realized like, hey, I'm pretty good at this. I don't feel awkward anymore.
When I started getting feedback, because then for a while, the first couple months, I was just stiff, just doing it by the book, reading the liners. Hey, don't forget, we got a concert this weekend. Call us up, blah, blah, blah. But then when I started adding my own personality, because I got this show on Saturday mornings. It was called Cypher Saturday. And I would mix and be a personality, which was not really done at the time, at that time slot. And then I started, like, hanging up on people when they called. And, like, I used to, like, remember the Nextel phones that chirped, like the walkie-talkies? So I had the sounds recorded into the radio station computer. And when songs were playing, I would just hit that noise. And people would call me up all the time, like, yo, I think your phone's on the microphone. And I'd just be like, beep, beep. And I used to just, like, people then got the joke. And when I would go out and DJ, and people would be like, yo, you were mad funny on the radio today. And I was like, well, what about my mixing? They're like, I don't know about that. But you were mad funny. And that's when I started to get comfortable, because you get positive feedback.
Yeah. And one of the things on that makes both the morning show and your podcast, the One Epstein podcast, is great is the relationship between you and Peter. It seems like you have a great chemistry now, but in the early days, there seemed to be like a little bit of tension that would kind of seep into on air a little bit.
All the time.
Yeah. How did you two get along at first?
We've always gotten along musically to a point. And we generally like the same stuff. But at the time, I was very closed off. I got a lot of mental issues. I was very like private, where he's like super open about his life. And also my word is my bond. Like, I don't like to break my word, where sometimes he'll say something and the next day the thing about Rosenberg is that he's so adamant about something one day. And if you're like me and your word is final, then he says he feels this way, that's how I think of him from now on. He feels white is white. Then the next day he'll be like, yo, white's kind of black though. And I'm like, nah, you said white was white and that's it. And so we used to clash a lot like that, but I'm better now.
Yeah.
I'm way more open now. I've gotten some therapy and I've dug deep inside and I've found myself.
Excellent. And one of the most sort of iconic times of your career, I think, was DJing at the Tunnel, sort of being the warm-up DJ for Funk Flex at the Tunnel on Sunday nights. The Tunnel, for those who don't know, was an iconic New York hip-hop club.
Yeah.
Can you take us through what a typical Sunday night at the Tunnel was like for you?
There's nothing typical about the Tunnel. It was, okay, so it's this club. This is like nowadays, you come to New York City, you can hear hip-hop 7 nights a week in any type of club. Back then, it wasn't a lot of hip-hop clubs. There was a few of them, and they were mostly off nights, like Thursday or Sunday, because Friday and Saturday was saved for, like, popular, like, house music or techno or whatever. So the Tunnel was, like, a famous techno club. And years before I got there, they started doing this party on Sundays called the Mecca. It was, like, 2,000, 2,500 people, which there's, like, no clubs like that anymore in New York City at all. Everything now is small, loungy. It was, like, 2,500 people packed into, like, a warehouse or whatever this place was, just long club. And the sound system was amazing because, like, famous techno and house DJs used to, like, DJ there. So the sound system was incredible. But for some reason on Sundays, when Flex used to do it, I mean, it was the thuggiest of thugs. Like, it was the bottom of the barrel of New York City of, like, these people, like, they had nowhere to go except Sundays. Like, they would, there was no dress code. And you could listen to, like, real grimy street hip hop. And it'd be packed. But, I mean, girls would be getting fondled. From like 1 to 2:30 was like packed. There'd be like liquor flying in the air. Girls would walk by. Girls would just get grabbed. Some girls knew how to handle it, but some girls would just be like, and run out of the club. They didn't know what they were getting into. People would come from out of state. People come from Baltimore, from Detroit, Miami. This was like a legendary club. Like, I would play early, like 9 o'clock, play to like 11, and Big Cap would get on. Big Cap would start getting it real, like start getting the vibes right. Then I would get on at 12:30 and play a half an hour of reggae. And then Flex would get on at 1 with like whatever the biggest record was at the time. Let's say like DMX, Where My Dog's At. That was like one of the big, that's what we call a tunnel banger. And he would play that record for at least 20, 30 minutes.
And people, as a way of introducing himself.
Yeah, and then like that at that moment, 1 o'clock at the Tunnel, it was like packed. And whatever was that song, sometimes the song like the Benjamins was a tunnel banger. Busta Rhymes, Put Your Hands Where Your Eyes Could See. Jay-Z, Ain't No. DMX, Where My Dog's At. And these records were just like, Cap would be on the mic just screaming like streets in Brooklyn. And Queens and the Bronx, and people would be going crazy. People would get thrown in the air. And the fights at the Tunnel were, I mean, insane. It would be like, because it's so packed. There'd be a fight, and they'd be trying to fight, and the crowd would just sway. And then they'd push back, and the crowd, like, hundreds of people, 200 people swaying with the fight. And then there was these... the security guards, they would call it the train, and it'd be like 20 security guards like in a line, and they would just march through the club looking for any type of problems. Or if there was a fight, they would just come marching in and grab everyone and throw them out. It was ridiculous.
Rap Beast. I was reading something you wrote on Complex about the Tunnel.
Yeah.
And your list of songs there, and it was interesting because I think you saw Southern hip-hop blow up in this real particular way. Particularly from people from New York who went down south to deal drugs.
Yes. Yes, because I was also DJing for Lil' Kim at the time. So back then, everyone loved Lil' Kim. The South, the West Coast, the Southwest, everybody.
And what around what time period is this, just for people who might not know?
This is like Lil' Kim album, I guess, was like 96, mm-hmm. 96, 97. When did Biggie's Life After Death come out?
I think that was 97. Yeah.
So it was like before this. It was like 96. And like, I'm talking about like, some New York rappers never went to Shreveport, Louisiana. And they would love Kim. Because she was like so sexual and so fun. Like, even if they didn't like New York hip hop, they liked that a girl was dressing like this and talking that shit. So anyway, I would go and meet a lot of DJs. And I mean, no, we would be in clubs where not one single New York song was playing. Nothing. And I was like, what is going on? Like, what is this music? And I would just trade records with DJs. And there'd be like a couple New Yorkers there. And I'm like, why are y'all here? And they're like, yo, we hustling. So then I come back home and I give the records to Flex. I'm like, yo, this record played and it was a riot. We were in Jackson, Mississippi. I have no idea what this song is or who this artist is, but there was a riot. The walls were shaking. And he was like, all right, I'll try it. You know, we would try it early and you would see the certain kids that they hustled. They would go out of town for months and then come back. And they were the only ones that knew it. And then we saw every week it spread a little more. Spread until this was like Bout It, It Ain't My Fault, like the Master P era. And then Little John started creeping in with his early records. And I saw the whole South, like the takeover.
I would say you saw this like 8 or 9 year slow build from the era you're talking about till like 2005 or so when it really broke through.
Yeah, when it was commercially successful, but like it was like all underground before that.
Yeah,
it was cool though. It was good. It was a fun time. It was a fun era.
Rap Bees.
I believe it. And when you were DJing with Kim, I know Mace used to come out on the road with you sometimes.
Yeah.
Nice. Were there any other performers you got to see in sort of the beginning stages of their career who would later go on to bigger things?
I know Mace came on the road with us, and Cam used to always be with Mace and Jim Jones. So before Jim Jones even rapped, and Cam used to write actually some songs for Junior Mafia, because he was supposed to sign to Biggie, and Mace, before his album came out, he used to come with us. Anybody else on the road? I don't remember anyone else. I mean, Kim was friends with Mary. She was friends with Missy. Like when Missy was like first starting out, I used to see Missy a lot. They were like really cool. The Brat. There was some other Brooklyn rappers. I forgot their name. But Biggie was supposed to sign them also. And I think Biggie was supposed to sign the Lox. And all this Puff like kind of took the Lox and made Biggie Puff took everybody.
What was Cam like back then? He is, by the way, the inspiration for Rap Genius.
Really?
Yeah.
How's that?
Our founders were talking about, I think, a line in Family Ties and what it meant, and that inspired them to build an early version of Rap Genius.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So
he's our spiritual godfather.
Yeah, Cam was cool. Everybody in, what was Mace's group? Harlem World. They were like always around Mace, Blinky Blink and all them. But Cam was, I remember me, we had some, there was always girls at Little Kim shows. So there was some girls in my room and Cam was in there and like, he was like, I had no game whatsoever. There'd be girls in my room and I would be playing with my MPC. I was like trying to make beats. And they would be the friends of the girls that were with all the other Junior Mafia guys.
You listeners can't see this, but our cameraman Jason just shook his head forlornly at that.
Yeah,
that
I had
part
an MPC. I was like, making beats right now, bitch. Fucking idiot I am. But Cam came in my room once with all these girls, and like that Harlem flavor, he was just like, I to this day wish I had game like this. He was like, yo, why don't you just, you know, put your drink down or whatever and come over to my room or whatever. And she's like, no, you probably got a girl. He's like, I got a lot of girls. You know what I mean? You know, friends. So I was like, yo, this is so crazy. But yeah, he was a dope rapper. He wrote Crush on You. Because Crush on You was a Little C's solo song on Little Kim's album. And I heard the version with him rapping it all the way through so that C's can memorize it. And then I heard it on the album, and the song was blowing up, so they had to make it a Kim single, so she had to, like, put a verse on it because she wasn't on the original version. He was dope back then. And then when, what was the song he had with DMX? Pull It came out, and the other song, Magnum, whatever, the 357. It's like I already knew him from rapping. He had played me Pull It song, I mean the 357 song way before, and I was like already on top of it.
Rap Genius.
Nice. And the period where you DJed for Kim, I wanted to talk about that for a second, because there was a point before that where you were kind of known as like the underground guy.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Working at Fat Beats and whatever. So how did it feel at that time to move between the underground and the mainstream worlds?
It was hard.
Because they were so far apart in a way that now, for people who don't remember that era, they were so far apart in a way that's like unthinkable now.
Yeah. Oh, it was horrible for me. Horrible. It was, but see, I had a plan. It was, I worked at Fat Beats, which was like all vinyl. They sold any party records you might need. If you need the top 10 party records, we had it there. But mostly it was independent, underground rap stuff. And I started working with DJ Riz, and his manager was the same lady who managed Flex, Jessica. And she was like, whatever, that underground stuff is cute, but you need to, like, this is a career. This is how you make money. And she was like, she was really cool with the Little Kim's camp, and she was like, they need a DJ. Before that, I DJed for Sadat X, which was like, I was in heaven. We went on tour. It was only for like a week because something happened. He got kicked off the tour. But for a week, we went to the West Coast.
Is there a story behind that?
I don't know the whole story, but I'll tell you. So we were on the West Coast. We were on a tour with Boot Camp, Exhibit, and the Alcoholics. And
it's like the
I'm like 19, meeting my Brand Nubian got me into rap. Brand Nubian is how I came up with the name Cypher. I'm on the road with Black Moon, Smith & Wesson, OGC, Exhibit, and Alcoholics. Alcoholics was like one of my favorite groups. And like Tash is just hanging out at the gas stations, smoking weed and eating. Like I was like in heaven. We went to do these shows. I loved it. But then like I heard Sadat on the phone arguing about, I don't know if it was like per diem or some kind of tour support money. And then an hour later they were like, yo, we're going to do the rest of the shows without you because we don't have money to pay you. We were in L.A. and I had to fly home. I was like, I was sad. I was like, how are you going to do it without a DJ? He's like, we'll find somebody. Whoever's at the club will play the songs.
Rap Genius.
So this is when I was like, rap, like everything had to be perfect. The rap show had to be insane. Whatever, I got kicked off. So then I got to go on the road with Lil' Kim and I was at Fat Beats and everybody was making fun of me. They're like, oh, you're going to go pop champagne? You're going to go get a fur jacket? And I was like, yo, listen. I'll go work for Lil' Kim. I'll meet the people that run the labels. And then I'll bring them our underground music. You know, like, this is the way in. Like, they don't know that we exist. So I'm going to be the bridge. I'm going to introduce them and play them that real shit. Because after they're tired of hearing all this champagne rap, they're going to hear the real shit, and they're going to be like, oh, this is what we should be doing. I was in a weird place. So I was like, then when I would go back to work at Fat Beats during the week, they would just make fun of me the whole day. Like, all day long, like, making fun of me. Like, he did this for Lil' Kim. To the point where I was like, I got upset. Like, yo, I'm trying to help you out. Like, I'm trying to, like, get us on the map. And I was like, you know what? It's not working out. And then Lil' Kim, like, once her album came out, like, she was like, I would work on the weekends with her before her album came out. You know, like, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, maybe. And she would just do, like, her single and, like, some R&B features and some Junior Mafia stuff. And once her album came out, I was gone. I was gone from, like, Tuesday to Sunday. And I had to quit. But I felt, like, really bad because, like, and then when I was with Kim and Junior Mafia, they made fun of me for being so underground. I was, like, straight army gear, army hat, like, you know, everything was camouflage and, like, super, like, independent hip-hop. And they used to be, like, they'd be in, like, full leather suits and, like, Kim would be in, like, bustiers and all that and, like, they would just make fun of me the whole time.
Wow, so you get it from both sides.
Both sides. I couldn't win. I couldn't win.
Yeah.
But I will say Kim and Junior Mafia are the ones who introduced me to like Tupac and Mace and all that stuff. Like, and it made me learn how to rock the tunnel better because these were the type of people that would be in the tunnel. And I would play like Mike Geronimo and Smith & Wesson, which was okay, but this stuff worked better. Mm-hmm. And they taught me, like, how to, like, play commercial, dug-out stuff as opposed to, like, this underground independent stuff.
Well, you've DJed, as you reveal the answer, for a ton of different people over the years. Who's been the most difficult person?
Difficult Kim. For,
even like a one-off?
Lil' Kim.
Yeah?
No doubt about it. Lil' Kim. I mean, I love her to death, but, I mean, they missed every flight. Like, if the the last show was Saturday night and we're supposed to go home Sunday, they would stay in a hotel all day and miss their flights. I'm like, I'm going home. No more shows. First flight, I'm out. I want to go home. Why would you want to waste time in this town when you could go home and do stuff? And then, like, this was, like, the vinyl era. So I have to DJ with vinyl. And the records would skip sometimes. And they would literally turn around and talk to me like I was, not even down with them. They'd be like, yo, DJ, you fucking up the show. And I'm like...
Like you're some random guy.
Yeah. I'm like, I came with you. And you're the ones jumping. Like, I'm like, yo, don't jump near me. And they would come near me and put their water on the DJ table. And the records would skip. And they would blame me. Like, it was unbelievable.
Wow.
But it was fun. I'm not saying it wasn't fun. But, yeah, she was definitely the most difficult.
Yeah. And... One of your main TV gigs was the Chappelle Show. What was that like working on?
I had no idea it would be.
I would say, do you have any idea like the lasting impact of those skits and legacy?
I mean, not when the Rick James skit came out, I knew. But like before, I didn't know I was part of like a cultural show that would change the face of like sketch comedy. I was just like Chappelle's like an underground hip hop head, and. I met him through Mos Def when I used to DJ for Mos Def.
Right, he did that skit on the first Quali solo album where he plays Nelson Mandela.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even know that. That's how I met him through them, but I didn't know that was him at the time.
Yeah.
And then we were out one night at some, maybe like a Green Lantern. I know Eminem and Green Lantern had something to do with Eminem, and Chappelle showed up. And I saw him. He was like, yo, come with me to this comedy club. And we went to the Comedy Cellar. He just walked in and got on. And we were hanging out, talking shit, talking about music. Like, this is what someone I could talk about, like, underground hip-hop with, like, that raucous era. He was like, yo, I'm starting this show. I'm looking for a DJ. Would you come shoot the pilot with us? Just, like, I need just music in beforehand. I was like, yeah, whatever. All right. And we went and shot the pilot, and it was real funny. And then it got picked up. So he's like, yo, you want DJ on the show? So I was like, yeah, sure. Did the whole first season, most of the first season. It was funny, had a ball. Second season, I was like, oh, it's back? Second season. Then now I'm like trying to like be more involved. So like if you watch some of the episodes, like I'd scratch some stuff and he would react to it. Like Little John, like, yeah. And then he shot the Rick James skit. And we would go to this studio. And there'd be an audience, and he'd already have it recorded and play it for the audience to get their laughter and reaction. And he played that, and we had to stop taping because people were laughing too much. Like, he wanted to continue talking, and they were laughing. The director was like, we have to cut it. Like, it's too long. And then afterwards, people would ask to show it again when the show was over. Like, could you play it again? And he played it again. So, like, for 6 months... I was saying, I'm Rick James, bitch, before anyone knew what I was talking about. And I would just tell them, I'm Rick James, bitch. And they're like, what are you saying? And then when it came out, I was already tired of it.
Right.
Like, and it blew up to, like, obviously the level it's at where it's like a famous sketch.
Rap Genius.
Yeah, that's what got me into comedy. He used to tell me, he's like, you're funny, man. You got to do stand-up. And I was like, in the stand-up? Why would I do that? I'm a DJ. Fuck it. I should have listened.
When did you first do stand-up, sort of totally take the plunge?
Oh, you know what's funny real quick? He told me, you know the Block Party?
Yeah, of course.
His movie, right?
Yeah.
He calls me. He's like, yo, can you DJ this party I'm having? I was like, what time? He's like, it's like 5 o'clock. I'm like, I can't. I'm on the radio at that time. He's like, oh, okay. Literally. So then,
that's it. Not, later it's a on movie, that day, not the Fugees will be there. Not like
he said. He's like, most Qua will be there. Amir from the Roots.
Yeah.
I was like, yo, I can't. I'm. I was like, maybe I'll come after, but I can't. I'm DJing on the radio. He's like, oh, okay, that's it. Then later on that day, I start hearing like, yo, he had Erykah Badu, Fugees, all the people that were there, Common. I was like, what? So I call him, like, yo, why didn't you, what the fuck? Why didn't you tell me? He's like, Sci-Fi, I told you. I was like, fuck. So he used to tell me I was funny to try stand-up. I was too scared. But then that, me being on MTV, a lot of, like, my interviews, people used to say I was, like, really sarcastic and funny. And then I'm trying to, like, if it must be a gift from above, if that word keeps coming up. So I started this comedy show called Don't Get Gas comedy series, and it was just a showcase for other comedians. But I would host it, and I would start getting laughs, and from there it just snowballed into like me being a stand-up.
Nice.
And doing comedy.
How'd you discover improv?
My one of my producers on the radio, this guy Jake, when we first got the morning show, he was like, sometimes I see you're a little like nervous to, because in the morning it's a different type of talk. You have to like be open, and like it's more about yourself. And he's like, I see you getting like a little stuck sometimes. He's like, you take an improv class.
Jake with the long hair and crazy voice.
You know Jake?
Yeah.
He looks like we call him the Crypt Keeper. So don't laugh. He's a sick man. He's very sick. He's very sick. He told me about UCB, and he took me to a Harold night, and I mean, I never saw anything like that in my life. And when I tell you I was hooked, like when I first got hooked on hip hop, I was hooked. Like it dragged me down this now 2-year mission of trying to get good at improv.
That's amazing. What relationship do you think it has to DJing? Do you notice any similarities?
To DJing?
Yeah.
Not really DJing, but like hip hop overall. The thing that I think people love about hip hop is when it's like raw. You know what I'm saying? Nowadays there's a lot of hip hop that's commercial and shiny, but like the reaction you get, like when you scrunch up your face when you hear like a beat, like a premiere beat or like something that makes you just get crazy. And also like back in the day when people used to freestyle. Freestyle and improv is pretty much the same because it's all coming off the top of your dome. And I feel like there's like this, the guy who like kind of invented long form improv and the Harold structure was this guy named Del Close. And he was like druggy, all about like just putting balls to the wall, trying stuff out, which I feel like is like early days of hip hop. He trained like John Belushi, Bill Murray, Chris Farley, like so many people. And it's like that, like Jim Belushi early days to me is like a old dirty bastard or somebody, like just saying whatever comes out of your mouth, like a red man or something, like super raw, and be willing to go on stage. Like, because they used to say hip hop was not real music because it was like taking other people's beats, and also there was no band on stage. It's like, yo, we're gonna go on stage with these turntables and we're gonna make a show like on the spot sometimes. Like just whatever happens, we're gonna make it up. That's the same as improv. You go on stage with nothing. There's no set up sketch. You get a suggestion and you make up the show on the spot. And sometimes it sucks. Like sometimes a hip hop show is like, this guy is doing nothing. He's just standing there. But sometimes it's great and you're like going like this and you're going crazy. It's the same with improv. Like sometimes they put it all together and you leave like, how the fuck did they just do that? You know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of connections.
Excellent. Well, I mean, it's funny because you mentioned before kind of poking fun at your younger self, wanting to like connect the underground and mainstream world of hip hop. But now it seems in some ways you're doing a similar thing with like the world of improv and stand-up comedy and hip hop.
Yeah. I mean, back then I didn't know what I was doing, but now years of experience and watching like I call myself like the Diddy of UCB because like Diddy in the early 90s, like there was no stopping him. So like that's what I'm trying to do now. Like you need to be with him. Like this producer needs to be with Biggie and this guy needs to be with Craig Mack. I'm like, this comedian needs to meet Talib Kweli because I think they get along. And Premier did my last show And there's a guy named Anthony Atamanik that smokes weed and talks about porn. Primo smokes weed and talks about porn. Those two guys should meet because it would work out perfectly. And yeah, it feels good, like, being able to connect all this stuff and having my own voice and my own lane.
Excellent. I wanted to get to a more sort of controversial moment of your career. The stuff around, if you want to talk about it, in 2010, the Haitian comments.
Oh, is that controversial?
Did people notice that? I mean, so the thing that I was curious about, what if anything did you learn from the firestorm around that, and also the objections people raised? Did you feel like they were legitimate? Did you feel like they were opportunistic, or was it a mix?
Yeah, it was a mix. But yeah, I said a joke on the air, and if to Haitians it would be offensive. That's why I literally like apologized 2 hours later. Like, I did say something that was offensive, so I apologized right away. I'm not trying to say, oh, I don't care. I'm standing my ground. Like, I did say something offensive, so I apologized for it. The problem afterwards was that where the firestorm came from was that it was misquoted, right? So what was on the news? I'm literally watching myself on Channel 7 News, and the quote was not what I said. So that pissed me off because it was like, if you're going to be mad at me for what I said, fine. I'll deal with that. I'll take my blows, and I'll deal with whatever the outcome is. But you're saying the wrong thing.
How was it misquoted? Do you remember?
I mean, it wasn't way off, but it was like, I said something like, I never said the words HIV. It was like a joke about a condom thrown at me, and I was like, I don't sleep with Haitian girls. That's all I said. But I don't sleep with Haitian girls because I have a girlfriend. Like, that was basically what I was saying. And it was like, oh, the quote was like, oh, Cypher Sounds refuses to sleep with Haitian women because of HIV. I was like, what? I never said that. That's crazy. And it was just, that quote went around. Oh, I mean, I heard myself on 1010 Wins, like the AM news channel, all the news on TV. So I wanted to fight it. Like, I had the real quote. I had it in my phone to play it. And I wanted to fight it, and the station, the big office, not here, but the main office, was like, it was a mistake, you apologize for it, we're leaving it at that. And you can't say anything else about it. And I had to like be quiet about it, even though I felt that I was wronged, you know? But whatever, I talked to all like these different Haitian organizations, and since then I've done like super, like a lot of community work and stuff. But the thing is, I was doing that before already. And I have like mad West Indian friends, and they were like, what? What's going on? Like, and people that didn't know me were like upset, but people that didn't know me were like, this is insane what's happening. And some people just try to make something big out of it, but there was nothing really there to make big, so it just went away. I mean, I almost got fired. Well, I could have got fired, but I was suspended indefinitely. At the time, it felt really bad. I thought I was going to lose my job, which my whole life is Hot 97. But then it turned out okay.
And speaking of Hot 97, you've been there a while now. You said 15 years?
Yeah, 15 years.
How's the station changed, both better and worse, over the time you've been there?
I mean, I don't know, the core of Hot 97 has never really changed. Some of the music we play and how we go about playing it obviously changes, especially once we got competition in the market. Because for a long time, we were just the only hip-hop station, and we were just going buck willy. Like, we were in the Wild West. We could do whatever we wanted. And then when competition, well, not competition meaning one radio station, but hip-hop blew up so much that a lot of radio stations started playing hip-hop, even, like, the pop stations. So then it took away from our, like, you know, like, we're being super so special. But hip-hop, I don't know, Hot 97, it only grows in a positive way. Like now, like we got hot97.com and we do way more stuff on the internet. But like, it's always been about like supporting, like, I hate the term real hip hop, but it's like real hip hop. You know, people from urban communities putting out music, don't matter where it's from, as long as if it's hot, we would play it. Even to the point like where Kay Slay's show and Rosenberg's show plays like street, like basically demos, you know, like, and you know, nothing's changed. We always played R&B. We always played like commercial rap, but it's what we play in between that. We take risk on records. We play album cuts that no one else played, and we support like artists in different ways, not just playing your single that the label's working. We're like, yo, this record has like an emotional tie to it, or like is like really sophisticated, and we throw those records into rotation, whereas other stations won't even know what that song is.
And I was watching sort of an interview / DJ set you did a while back on Fat Beat's Last Day. This connects, oh, yeah. I swear. Because you were talking about how when you DJ, you try to put in something for the underground heads, even if it's just an instrumental while you're reading station announcements or something. And so I was curious about that, like trying to balance material you like, music that makes you happy, with, you know, stuff you have to play that maybe you either don't like or are not that excited about, or, you know, stuff that you have to do because the station says so, or whatever.
Like, how do we balance?
Keep that stuff in balance, yeah.
I mean, first and foremost, like, it's not that hard. It's a job. You know what I'm saying? Like, you get a paycheck. So you have to listen to the powers that be. But it's like, if certain people like a song, you have to play it. Like we're entertainers basically, and we're entertaining the people. Now, if we think that they should like something, we can definitely suggest it and try to work it in. But if it's not working, it's not working. You can't force it. Everything is not for everybody. And when a song blows up, sometimes I think it's stupid or I don't like it, but if it gets a reaction on the radio or in the clubs, why, like, I'm not here to, like, tell you what to like. I like when people dance or go crazy at a party or call up the radio station and say they like something. So it's never really been a problem to me. Some people, like, get, like, so worked up about it. Like, Rosenberg, like...
I was going to say, that name comes to mind. He has,
in the studio in the morning time, he has fits. Like... He gets so upset, and he's like, why aren't we playing Badass? And I'm like, because it's 7:30, and moms are taking their kids to school, and they just want a little something uplifting before they go to work, you know? It's like, he doesn't understand time and place, and he wants to, like, work his Action Bronson. And I'm like, sometimes we play it, you know, we play it once or twice, and we get a big reaction because the underground fans... It just shocked them. So they're like, oh, shit. But it's not something you could play all day, you know? I don't have a problem with entertaining people. It's fun. It's the job.
And sort of winding down real quick, I know you spent a lot of time as an A&R person for, you know, Star Trek and Rock La Familia and all that kind of stuff. With Star Trek in particular, you know, what was that like? Was it like working with someone like Pharrell, who seems like he's always doing 85 million different things?
Yes, he was. It was great. I didn't get any work done, but it was great. Because like, I was like, I didn't handle Pharrell's music that he produced for other people. I was just handling like the Star Trek artists. But the problem was Pharrell was always working on other people's stuff. So it was a hassle to get stuff done I was mainly working with Eclipse and this kid Fam Lay at the time. And but I mean, I loved it. Like, I love picking beats and listening to, I mean, listen, watching Pharrell and Chad make music was like the highlight of my life. And like, I mean, we did the second Clips album.
classic, absolute Stone Cold classic.
Yeah, like I heard, like I had those songs for so long, like Keys Open Doors, and there was another one I liked on there. It was like kind of up tempo. I forgot the name of it. It was fast, and I wanted that to be the single, and nobody fucking agreed with me.
Yeah, that well, that record.
Trill was it Trill?
Yeah, I think that was it. Yeah, I feel like that record in particular. It's like they, and since you were there, maybe you can tell me. It seemed like they were just kind of thinking, like, how weird can I get and still get away with it? Like, how minimalist and stripped down the Neptunes.
The Neptunes.
Like, how minimalist and like.
Yeah, strange. They were like. Yeah, they were definitely working on like a Clips sound, you know, because what happened was with Pharrell, you do a record with him. Like, there's a lot of beats out there in the world that other people have as their songs that were originally Clips beats. And somebody would like it, and Pharrell would sell it to them. And I had to literally, like, say, Pharrell, you can't sell these beats. Like, we have songs to them already. They're made. Like, we would have to, like, steal the files from Pharrell so that he wouldn't play it for other people. It was retarded. It was ridiculous. But I worked on like the Khalees album, the second Khalees album, some other artists that never came out. But I mean, it was amazing. Like that time with them, I wish I could have stayed there, but I started getting more radio work and went to Sirius and Hot 97. It was fun though.
I believe it. So you've done, you know, radio and television also. Like how do those, what's different about those?
Oh, TV, you get treated like a king, and radio, you get treated like a piece of dog shit every day. And I do the morning show. I do the morning show on Hot 97, which is the most listened to time slot of radio. And we get treated like shit, nothing. TV is like, and mind you, I don't like to be catered to. I'm like a kind of like a self-reliant type of guy. But TV, like, there's somebody sprucing you up, bringing you water, like people get you clothes. This is how it is on a TV set. Is everything all right? Do you need anything? Is everything okay? No, I'm good. I'm good. Do you need help with your bag? Would you like some water? Is everything okay? Would you like to sit down for a while? Like to the point, like when I used to be on MTV and there's like an audience there, and when we were like in between taping, they would like rush me away so that the kids wouldn't bother me. I'm like, nah, I'm good. I'm going to sit with the kids. Like, we're going to sit with them for a while. And like, don't. They would tell the interns, don't talk to them. Don't talk to the VJs. And radio is just like, get here, shut up, do this, shut up again. It's bad.
Nice. And finally, I know you have a new, coming up next month, a new weekly night. Mixing improv and hip-hop anecdotes. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm trying to explain improv to people. It's literally a bunch of us go on stage with nothing planned whatsoever. We get a suggestion, and we make up a whole hilarious comedy show on the spot. So what I'm doing is sometimes they'll have like this famous show is called ASCAT, and they'll have like famous like comedians or like writers or people from SNL come and tell stories. And then the show is made up from those stories. So I'm doing it different. I'm bringing hip-hop artists. And so far I've done two of them. And they already want me to do a weekly show because the reaction is phenomenal. I had RZA for the first one, but the last day he canceled, he couldn't come. So Nori did it. Nori's stories are hilarious on their own.
Yeah.
Hilarious. So he told a story about being in jail with Capone and some other people, and they would go to church only to steal the Bible paper so they could roll weed in it. And like, so we go on stage and act out like we're in a church chapel, and we're passing around the Bible, and it's funny as hell. So then Premier did my second one, and he told some Biggie stories that were like, I mean, the audience was cracking up just from his story. And then like he said, Premier used to live with Branford Marsalis for a little while, and they would go hang out with Biggie on the corner, but then Guru got arrested, and the cop was telling the people to move Guru's car, so Biggie hopped in the driver's seat but didn't know how to drive. So, but he just hopped in so the cop would think he was going to move it. And Premier was like, hopped in the passenger seat. And Biggie's like, I don't know how to drive. So then I go on stage with another guy and I act like I'm Biggie getting driving lessons from Biggie's mom. Yo, it's crazy. So it's the whole thing is made up. It's super fun. It's going to be every Friday night at 9 o'clock at UCB East, which is on Avenue A and 3rd Street. And I'll have some of the dopest hip-hop artists, producers, DJs, tell true life stories, and then we make a whole show out of it. And it will be thoroughly entertaining.
That was our talk with Cypher Sounds. If you liked what you heard, find us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so that you'll never miss an episode. While you're visiting us on iTunes, make sure to leave us a review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get amazing guests like Cypher Sounds. Join us in 2 weeks when our guest will be Michael Holman, the hip-hop impresario who created hip-hop's first television show, Graffiti Rock, which is coming up on its 30th anniversary. Outside the Lines is created and written by Sean Sataro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
I was like, I don't sleep with Haitian girls. That's all I said.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I've gotten some therapy, and I've dug deep inside.
The interview was recorded by Jason Potential Chandler.
Whatever, that underground stuff is cute, but you need to, like, this is a career. This is how you make money.
And our music is by Psionic.
Making beats right now, bitch.
We'll see you in 2 weeks outside the lines.
Oh, it's mostly him. I mean, you don't really, you know, people, you know, I know what I look like, so. But I mean, you're an artist. Use your discretion, you know?